This week, we continue our interview with Kyle J. Howard on racial reconciliation and civil discourse in the church. This is Matthew Garnett. Welcome to In Layman's Terms.
It's important to understand that in American history, America, because it bought into racial constructs, which are false, racist false, but because it bought into that ideology, it racialized something that was neutral, which is racially neutral, which is capitalism. I've an evil plan.
Like I said, we have second part of our interview with Kyle J. Howard, and we're very pleased to have that good conversation. Kyle and I had again. We're not going to agree on a whole lot. Our approaches to this issue are very different, but not talking about it doesn't solve anything. We can walk away and say, "Hey, I completely disagree with you," and he can walk away and say, "I completely disagree," and that's fine. And you know, that's where we were before, but at least we afforded each other the opportunity for some understanding, and I think we did reach some understanding on this, and that's really where I think perhaps a lot of things could be solved in our day and time if people would just have some civil discourse on these things like we did here. So anyway, I appreciate very much Kyle for coming on and doing this interview, and I'm looking forward to sending the second part of it out to you guys. But let me also remind you that we are doing the Kenya Well Project, and we want you to donate $50 to the Kibos Hope Academy to have the Well Project. And what has happened is, since the children at Kibos have heard about our efforts to have the well drilled for them, they started sending letters. And if you go to our website, laymansterms.org, you'll see one of the letters there. And I just want to share a bit of that letter that's posted at laymansterms.org with you this week. This letter comes from Derek, and Derek writes us and says, "I am Derek, age 17 years, and the third son of a family of a late father and still living widowed mother with five children, who grew up in the village of Kanyango in Kisimu. He is a partial, he says, I'm a partial orphan, and I spend all my spare time with my mother, who is a businesswoman, to raise her family. I am a pupil of class 8 in Kibos Hope Academy and managed to enter the school this year in 2016 through the former teacher, Miss Alice. I like this school because it provides me with free tuition, for I have not enough money for school fees. It also provides me with skills and knowledge, so that my teachers had made it possible for me to receive marks of 380, and I entered here when I had 277 marks from my former school. It also helped me to develop potential. Mentorship through my teachers. I need this well to be dug in our school to provide with a universal water source for domestic and farm use. This well should help us with other purposes, such as irrigation on a piece of our orchard for growing both fruits and vegetables." And the letter goes on, and you can finish reading it there. And you might notice his English is a little broken, but this is like his third language. He speaks Swahili first, then French, and then English. And so these children are learning another language and are writing to us in another language. And obviously, Derek is a very intelligent, very capable young man with lots of potential. And his handwriting is beautiful. You should see it. You should go to the website and take a look at it. But anyway, these are the folks that we're raising the money, $50 to from each of our listeners to dig this well. So I hope that you'll go ahead and donate the $50 so we can help Derek and all the other students there. And we've got many more letters. We've got these letters in. And so we're going to just start reading them here and posting them on our website, and we hope you'll read them, and it will motivate you to give that one-time gift of $50. So like Monica said last week, we can break this cycle of poverty. Okay, well, There's that. Please donate your $50, and we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, we're continuing to talk with Kyle J. Howard from the MLK 50 conference, and here's the remainder of the interview with him. Here we go.
The government will be like, there's no way we can do that. You know, that's ridiculous. And we should be like, you know, yeah, it sounds ridiculous, but that's what love would compel.
Right, right. Well, yeah.
And so I don't think. Yeah. So yeah. Let me say that I don't think that reparations will ever actually happen. And when I say reparations, I'm talking about government.
Sure.
I'm not talking about individual. I'm not necessarily talking about a paycheck. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it will ever happen because we live in the city of man.
Yeah.
But that does not mean that those who are citizens in the city of God, who are sojourners in the city of man, should not have the ethic.
Right, right, right. And that, I mean, I resonate with that. I mean, one skill I have is I have a Class A CDL, and I can drive big rigs, and I can teach people how to drive big rigs. And one thing that I've been toying with and going to talk to one of my pastors about is, you know, what would it look like if we started a truck driving school out of our church, you know, that would be free for the people in our city, you know, particularly the underprivileged and that sort of thing, and teach them how to drive trucks. And it's a very lucrative business, actually. And, you know, some of that sort of thing would be, I think, fairly, you know, kind of along the lines you're speaking here. But so along the lines of the, you know, again, the welfare, the entitlement programs. You know, some of my favorite speakers on this subject are men like Thomas Sowell, Jason Riley, you know, even a man like John McWhorter with The Atlantic, Glenn Lowry, who's an economics professor at Brown. Some of the things that they're concerned with the quote-unquote entitlement programs is that it's actually binding people to a subsistence type of life. So in other words, yes, we'll give you this money, but you'll never get there's no way you'll ever get beyond this amount of handout that the government's going to give to you. And they articulate as that even as some form of slavery or some kind of prison. And what we really need to figure out is how to get people to break out of that subsistence living and really flourish. And
yeah,
so,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, maybe talk about some of your ideas on that.
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say absolutely. So one, and I think that Christians walking as sojourners in the city of man, they will conflict with both Republicanism and the Democrat Party. So both, they're going to conflict with both sides.
Sure.
I have no problem saying that. So that the Republican Party, honestly, in my view, doesn't really care about marginalized communities. Especially racially marginalized communities. The Democrats, they will give the impression that they care, but what they're really after, it's in many ways, it's just a farce. They don't really care. And even the way that some of their policies are done demonstrates that. And so when you think about even how, and this is where people see the kind of the mix up, is they look at what the Democrat Party does in regards to giving government assistance or their policies on that and say what they're trying to do is create a kind of codependent relationship here so that they can get minority votes. Okay, so that'll be the argument that many will make. What I would say is, I think that if we're operating out of biblical ethics, then the conclusion that we come away with is not just simply we need to give people stuff, but it's a matter of training up. It's a matter of discipleship. That what the Christian worldview is not simply, hey, give somebody something. The Christian worldview is help people flourish.
Right.
And so even when I'm thinking about something like reparations, as I've defined it, I'm not just simply talking about, I didn't just say, hey, give somebody a paycheck. I said, hey, help somebody go to school.
Sure.
Help somebody impoverished who doesn't have the economic wherewithal to actually be able to go to a university, go there, be educated so that they can better serve the community.
Right.
The thing, what you were just mentioning, there are ways in which we can build ourselves up as a society rather than marginalizing communities, then scoffing at marginalized communities for being marginalized. And so what I would say is that then the Christian church must have a comprehensive ethic And it should do things like you're doing, where it should be able to live in a way that demonstrates that comprehensive ethic and then point to the world and say, follow me. This is how you, this is what love looks like. Not what you, not worldly love. This is what godly love looks like. It looks like starting a training for trucking, you know, and at the church and having people come. So we're not just, we're not giving, necessarily just giving a handout, but we're helping people actually develop skills so that they can flourish comprehensively.
All right.
You know, so I'm not for handouts in the sense of say that single mother just simply give her a paycheck. Okay. Though I think that we should at some, that there has to be a point where we help people live. We don't let them starve to death. But I would say the comprehensive goal would be to help that single mother be able to flourish as a single mother, which includes being able to provide for her. So a way in which she can go to school, to night school, learn a skill, learn something that she can do to contribute to society, as well as care for her children, rather than just being mocked at as being codependent with the Democratic Party.
Right. Right. Yeah. This is really interesting because I think we're converging on some ideas here, that if the church could lead the way on this and preach by its actions, you know, that's exactly, you referred to St. James, and that's exactly what he preaches there, is that, you know, we should lead by example. And you very eloquently spoke of how the church has done that in the past. And I think that's something definitely the Christian church has lost, especially in West America and in North America and in the West in total. The church has ceased to lead by example in these ways. And we call upon the government to fix these things. And I think, as you and I both know, the government is fairly inept at fixing things, it seems to me.
Absolutely.
Right. So right. I think we're, you know, converging on an idea there that if local churches could start initiatives like this and start saying, hey, this is what we're doing, you know, exactly like you said, follow us. You know, this is the Christian ethic. I'm all in on that 100%. Now let me throw a curveball at you here, from my experience at Claremont, is, say for instance, I did start a truck driving school out of my church, and started training young black men how to drive trucks. And they went out, there are the majority of people I went to school with at Claremont would call that utterly racist, would say that I am just simply turning those poor black people into white people. Now the way we used black and white at Claremont was was very, very James Cone-ish. This is one thing that drives me nuts when speaking of Dr. White. When he talks about James Cone, he has no idea what Cone is talking about. And because when James Cone says white, what he's really talking about is ideology. He's not talking about skin color. And you've got to be really discerning when you're listening to discussions about race, is when somebody says, okay, the white God is racist. What they mean by that is the God that says that chattel slavery is okay is racist, and that is absolutely correct.
The white supremacist God is
right, and so that and Cone is spot on. That's, you know, we should not worship that God. And so that's what I think. Maybe just some insight, perhaps. And I don't think anybody's looking into it too deeply, or that deeply, or understanding kind of where this language comes from. Because when you say social justice to me, I've got a picture in my mind what that is, which is capitalism is racist, really Western liberalism, in the classic sense of the term, free markets, democratic republic, that's racist. And I've got plenty of Marxist friends who would say that flat out. You know, America is racist because it's founded on liberal capitalism. And for me to take young black men in my community and train them how to thrive in that system is, in fact, racist. You're just turning black people into white people. You're just turning them into another form of slave. So so that sort of attitude alarms me. And so that's what I'm always trying to figure out. And the first thing that kind of piqued my interest in this was when I heard David Platt speak at the conference about this, and he was using these terms, and I'm going, okay, he can't possibly be using these terms in the way I understand these terms. So there's got to be something else going on here. I don't know, maybe speak to that a little bit, in the sense of, is there a way that I think the church needs to be exactly what you're talking about, demonstrate some more leadership in this area and do the things that you and I just basically agreed on, where the church institutes some of these programs. We're just like you said, Southern Seminary has instituted some of these tuition breaks for my own minorities, not with any government coercion or anything else. They've just on their own decided to do this. How can we communicate all of this in a way that doesn't make everybody freak out and think, okay, we're driving towards socialism and we're going to be, we're going to be communist China in 10 years. Is there a better way to do this? Maybe speak to me about that a bit.
I think that's an excellent question, and it's an interesting dynamic there. And I think that there is a misunderstanding in some sense, not on your end.
Sure.
But I think how people understand, the history of America, and even as it relates to capitalism. So I would not say capitalism is racist. I will say that America has racialized capitalism.
Okay.
Very different. And it's racialized capitalism because it has the way in which that its capitalism was made successful is through racialization. It's through taking indigenous Americans and then later Africans as slaves and all the brutality and everything that came with slave culture. So white supremacy and slave culture has been the things that have fueled the American capitalism. And then even to this day, as we think about the major economic disparities, how much more wealth the white people have than black, and a lot of that has to do with, property dynamics and, again, redlining and all those other kinds of things. And so it's important to understand that in American history, America, because it bought into racial constructs, which are false, racist false, but because it bought into that ideology, it racialized something that was neutral, which is racially neutral, which is capitalism. And so I would that's just nuance there. But in a bigger thing, what I would say is you will have people tell you that you are potentially to call you racist for seeking to abound in love. Sure. I have people every day tell me I'm racist for seeking to abound in love.
Right.
And abound in unity. I have Christians telling me that I'm racist for seeking to abound in love and pursue unity. and racial harmony within the church, and ethnic harmony within the church. So that may happen, and that will happen if you are rejecting the ward's ideologies and systems, rejecting the ideologies of the city of man, which include Marxists, it includes Republicans, it includes Democrats and liberals, and so if you're rejecting that and simply seeking to abound in love, you're going to get hate from all those sides. Mm. But what you'll also get is people who feel loved and people who actually come, who you're able to serve and you're able to build with. And so what I would say is apologetically, you want to engage with that misunderstanding regarding capitalism. Capitalism is racially neutral, but it's been racialized because of America buying into the construct of race, the false construct of race. And so that's different than saying capitalism is racist.
Right.
And so apologetically, I would engage like that. Practically speaking, I would ignore that and seek to abound in love. And so if you want to love the community by taking what you know how to do, what God has gifted you with, whatever wisdom or knowledge you have, to you want to pour that out to serve those in your community, then that's simply seeking to abound in love. And people will criticize that, but people have always criticized those who have sought to abound in love, especially Jesus.
Right.
And so I would just utterly reject those worldly systems and say that, no, I'm rejecting all of that, and I'm going to seek to abound in love and seek for either way, abounding in love. And this is what I know how to do. I want to do this, but what I won't do is I'm not going to seek to force people in the community, say black people in the community, to assimilate to me culturally in order to obtain this knowledge. So I can teach them how to drive a truck, but I'm not going to culturally assimilate them into my whiteness as a contingency in order to learn what information I have. Does that make sense? So,
well, I'm not sure. Well, now, hang on a second. I'm not sure that does. So explain that to me a little bit as far as assimilate them into the culture of whiteness. I don't know what that – I'm not sure what you mean by that. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm being very basic. So it'd be like I'm not going to get in this car with you and teach you how to drive unless you're going to listen to country music on the radio.
Oh, okay.
Or, so, I mean, that's a very kind of petty example. My point there is simply – I'm not going to set cultural expectations, meaning this person does not have to become white identify with me in my cultural preferences and ideas and perspectives in order to obtain the knowledge that I have. I have this knowledge that I can teach these people, and I can teach them with them still wholly being themselves.
Right. Okay. Okay. Now let me.
So they don't have to become members of my church. Okay. They don't have to come. They don't have to wear what I would wear. They don't have to put on, you know, wear a suit. You know, they don't have. So they don't have to assimilate into my culture and my bubble in order to be accepted by me as a teacher.
Okay. All right. Well, let me dive down on that a little bit. So, for instance, I have a very difficult time understanding Ebonics. I do. this is something that I'm really on. John McWhorter is really fascinating on this topic because he wrote a whole book on this called "Talking Black, Talking Back," and he defends.
I have trouble understanding rednecks. So
well, right, right. So. Essentially, the argument that McWhorter makes is that Ebonics are perfect. That's perfectly fine. It's a dialect of the English language. However, what we have to come to some sort of commonality about is at least a trade language. So if I've got guys that are going to come in and learn how to drive trucks with me, I've got to be able to understand what they're saying. And if I've got a guy who insists on speaking Ebonics, I'm not sure what the move is there. Is it okay? I need to learn how to understand Ebonics, or does he need to learn how to speak? I guess the trade language. That's the big question, kind of that McWhorter puts forth. And so I don't know. Maybe give me your opinion on that.
Yeah. So first, I'll say that almost all black people know how to code switch. And code switch basically means to switch up the way that they talk, depending on if they're talking to black people or white people.
Okay.
Now, excuse me. And so how I'm talking to you, when I hit the block, I can talk to a bunch of different kinds of crowds. And so we know how to talk in different contexts. I just kind of did it just a second ago.
Sure.
And so code switching is something that's understood. Black people have to do it in order to survive. Now, there are people who have only and solely been committed to a specific demographic. So, say someone who's from the hood, who's never left the hood. That's all they know. That's all they've ever been to, and so they've never had to worry about code switching. And so those people exist as well. And what I would say to that is that there's a difference between assimilation and let me think of the best way to put this. There's a difference between assimilation and accommodation.
Right.
Assimilation is when someone has to conform to a specific cultural expression in order for acceptance. Accommodation is when someone flexes or maneuvers themselves into a specific kind of context so that they can flourish within said context. So there's a way of saying, hey, you must talk like this in order to be accepted. That's assimilation. It's another thing to teach people saying that, hey, the way that you're going to be received by these people is if you talk a certain kind of way, and this is the way you talk if you want to be if you want white people to perceive you in a certain kind of way. Mm-hmm. This is what accommodation looks like.
Right.
And how you communicate the necessity to learn a language or learn a dialect will determine whether or not you're seeking to assimilate someone or you're seeking to train someone how to accommodate.
I got you.
So Chick-fil-A doesn't seek to assimilate people into nice people. They seek to help the people that work there to accommodate to the clientele. So it's, hey, when you're here, say my pleasure to the customers. If you're talking to your friends, you know, on break, and you're like, hey, what's up? Hey, what's good? You know, we don't care. But when you're talking to a customer, you need to accommodate to that context. And so say my pleasure.
Right.
Does that make sense?
And yeah. So, no, that makes it a lot. That is really helpful, Kyle. That it is. Because, again, you know, if I'm teaching somebody how to do something like drive a truck, I've got to be like, okay, look, first of all, you know, I'll try to learn your dialect and you try to learn mine. But I'm telling you, when you're out there and you're delivering stuff and you're the most of the people that you're going to run into, you're going to have to adapt to them. You know, you're just going to have to, and that sort of thing. So that is super helpful.
So if you're coaching people on how to do business, and you're letting them know that, hey, you recognize that this is accommodation, and this is what we all need to accommodate. I need to accommodate. We all need to accommodate to the customer, but you don't devalue them by saying that, hey, you must assimilate. So you must be like me in order to be received by me. Rather, you're saying, hey, this is what you need to do in order to sell. Then you're able to build a relationship where there's a mutual respect, and that person still feels themselves. It doesn't feel like you're trying to make them something they're not.
Right. Well, and yeah, I think that's really important, and I think that message is, I could see how even in your own community how you would be met with some resistance on that, because there are those who would say, hey, look, you know, we shouldn't have to change anything we do in order to survive in this world. We've already been the ones that have suffered enough. You know, they're going to have to come to us on this. And that's where kind of James Cone and I depart. Plus that, I really feel like James Cone leans black nationalist. Maybe you can correct me on that. Just as an example, when we were at Claremont, I mean, there was a whole section of our theology course where we compared and contrasted James Cone and Martin Luther King Jr. So there was really kind of a division on Claremont with race. Is, you know, are you with Cone? Are you with Martin? Are you, you know, James? Are you Martin? Are you Malcolm? Well, really, that's how it went. Are you Malcolm? Are you Martin? And there was a few back in that time, there was a few Malcolm folks. But most of us were Martin. We wanted everybody to, you know, we didn't want to have to go, you know, we didn't think that.
Are we talking about sanitized Martin? Or like,
well, yeah, Martin? Sanitized Martin. Definitely sanitized Martin. It definitely was. And we recognized that. But the whole idea was, and this was a good thing at Claremont, was that what we ultimately hoped was that the solution to all this wasn't going to have to be a situation where, okay, the oppressed are going to be the oppressors now. That was really something that was very distasteful at Claremont, and we were always talking about this and debating it and how can it work, and you know, maybe it can't work, maybe just the oppressors have to become the oppressed have to become the oppressors for a while, and then after a long period of time, then the oppressed become the oppressors, and then that's how the world will go. And maybe, you know, maybe that is, you know, as you brought up Augustine, maybe that just is the city of man. And that's the way some of this is just going to go down, unfortunately. That was, you know, that's just a side observation on my part. But I brought all that up just to kind of, I think you're aware of this. But when I heard David Platt speak, that's what concerned me about the way he was talking, was that for someone like me, who's really informed on this whole, you know, kind of the milieu of this whole thing, what he was talking about, was if he knew what he was saying, if he knew what he was driving at, you know, he's driving really at, you know, at a more of a socialist Marxist, you know, if you will, you know, an Eldridge Cleaver, Black Panthers type of idea here. You know, that would include modern figures like, you know, Jesse Jackson, Louis Farrakhan, these sorts of things. So this frightens people, I think, when they hear this kind of language. And so that's what maybe is a little a bit of a frustration for me, because I don't think that's where David Platt is really coming from, or where you're coming from. Just in our conversation here, I can tell that. And so what I'm wondering is, you know, it just seems like there's a major miscommunication going on here. You know, again,
absolutely is a major miscommunication. And I get asked this by black and white, to be honest with you. I've had a sister ask me this recently.
I got you.
Where she said, Kyle, some of the language you use is what I think is triggering these angry white people.
Right.
No offense.
Yep.
And I was like, so have you ever considered changing your language? And I asked, I was like, so what language am I using that you think is triggering? And she said, you're using terms like social justice, or you use terms like white and like black. You know, why don't you say something like Caucasian, or you know, don't use race at all? So she's like, she was just rationalizing with me about some of the language. But none of the things I was saying was actually like abrasive or like was like radical. They were like really just basic terms. Someone's white, they white.
Right.
And so what I told her was, in all love and respect, the burden here is not on me to be like Jell-O and try to mold myself, again, assimilate, mold myself into whatever the white people who don't like me will find acceptable in regards to my speech. The burden here is on people to practice 1 Corinthians 13. Love believes all things, hopes in all things, does not insist on its own way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So if I'm saying, hey, my white brothers and sisters, this is something that is a pattern among you that you guys could change, and it would help reconciliation. And people are like, you're a racist. How dare you say the word white? That's not on me because I said white. That's on them for believing I'm a racist because I said white, when we're family.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, they could easily be like, brother, and they should ask themselves why they're offended by that use of that. So I think there's psychological reasons for that mixed in with, you know, generations of racializations. But my point is being that I think that much of the issue is that there is a one community of people who for centuries have had to study another community of people for their very own survival. My ancestors and even me, I've had to master white culture in order just to survive. Just to be able to graduate from seminary, I had to master white theology and white theological expressions. And there's another side, because it has had a degree of privilege, it hasn't had to learn anything about black culture. It hasn't had to study the black community. And so it just believes what it believes. And I think that what that ultimately leads to is you have one community that is very experienced and knowledgeable, you know, regarding where society is at regarding race issues. And you have another one that is not. And honestly, if I'm frank, I think that insecurity leads to, when these conversations come up, this is just an automatic shutdown.
Yeah.
And so when a black person is saying that, hey, this is something that I've seen as someone who's lived for 30 years around majority white people, this is something that I've observed. And because white people have never seen it, never observed it, didn't even know that existed, the reaction is, no, this can't be.
Right.
You know, rather than, and how dare you say this? Why are you attacking me? Rather than, brother, help me see what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And then if they don't see it, then saying that, hey, we disagree, but at least saying that, hey, I know that you love me because we're family and you're saying this, so help me see. Let's talk about this. But again, when charity goes out the window, when the understanding that we're all family goes out the window, even cross-denominationally, we're family, we're one church, and then you have suspicion that comes up because of words used rather than desire for clarity. Right. And so I do think that there is this charge language, but there's charge language because there's one side that is using language that has been used for a long time in these conversations. You know, people have been studying these issues for a long time. The white fragility is a legitimate psychological reality that's been understood, and many of books have been written on it. Same with white privilege.
Yeah, I just well, I was just going to mention, the author's name is completely escaping me, but I just read White Fragility.
That book will make some people mad.
Yeah.
but these are psychological and social understandings that have been processed and worked through for decades, and their community that has James White, he's never looked at any of that. He's never had to even think about those things, but engages as if he's mastered them, and he hasn't. So when he speaks, he just comes off as not only abrasive but just completely misinformed. Same thing goes with someone like MacArthur. MacArthur spends 13 hours a day reading the Bible. Praise God for that.
Yep.
But he's devoted himself to be an expositor and a pastor, not a sociologist, and not someone who's engaged in the public square regarding issues of justice and justice in the social realm. So it's okay that he doesn't understand or doesn't know these things.
Right.
The issue is whether you take on a posture that's willing to learn, or whether you take on this posture like, no, even though I haven't spent any time studying this, I'm white and all my minority brothers and sisters are wrong.
Right.
And so I think that there's a humility that has to come in here.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I do. My question would be, so here would be my approach. You know, I can't completely put myself in your shoes, but if you know, this is my best try. Okay. So give me some grace. I would try to, as best I can, communicate, you know, in their language, you know, and maybe, I don't know if that's asking again. I agree with you that I think it's unfair to ask, you know, black people who have suffered in this country the way they have, to continually accommodate, but it seems like even we're so polarized that maybe we can get there. It seems like we've made progress, in my estimation, and you know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the answer is to say, okay, enough is enough. We're drawing a line here. You guys need to start understanding us. You guys need to start studying. You guys need to start, you know, getting your act together on this. And, you know, we'll be here when you understand it. That's my attitude, is I need to get this. That's why, like I say, my favorite guys are Thomas Sowell, Jason Riley, Larry Elder, John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry. These guys that really make a lot of sense of this whole thing to me. As a white person, but at the same time, I'm also reading White Fragility, you know, because I'm trying to just piece all this together. I think it's incumbent upon me, if I say I really care about this stuff, to really move in that direction. I don't know, Kyle. Tell me what you give me your temperature on this. Are guys like James White and John MacArthur, are they at a place where we can expect them to move toward that area?
Yeah, so asking me is a little bit tricky because I've kind of become, it seems like, the poster child for the reform Christian community to attack and like tear down and everything else. So I get it. I get a lot of like stuff. But I'm still very optimistic. I think that one of the things that I said, even with regards like the Southern Baptist Convention, is that the conservative resurgence was a battle for the mind of the convention, and now we're seeing a reformation of the heart.
Sure.
And so it's split. I think that God is doing a tremendous work. I think God is revealing the deep malady of the American church as it relates to both racism and misogyny. And he's bringing it all to the surface. And I think that he's going to deal with it. And I think that we're going to see a profound renewal, even revival. you know, in the coming years, once there's a cleansing that takes place. I've taken on the role, and other men that I've talked to, professors, theologians, pastors, there's simply not enough time in the day, nor energy in my body to debate and argue with people who are not even seeking to practice Christian charity. Yeah. on a most basic level. And there's a reason why I haven't done any clapbacks. I'm not in debating and arguing with James White or Phil Johnson or anything like that, or even giving too much attention to the statement that was issued, because I see the spirit behind it. And it's like, I could either spend my time and energy on that, or I can answer all the messages and all the people that have reached out to me who are actually truly seeking to grow,
right,
and learn. Now, mind you, again, as you said, you read the book by Fajiri. I've had Christians who, the days they reach out to me and they're like, I really want to know. Then I say something and they come out and they're like, they basically message me in all caps. I can't believe you said this. What are you doing? Why did you say this? I'm offended. So they go off of me and I respond graciously and kindly. And then they come back like, man, I overreacted. I'm so sorry. You're actually right now that I think about it. And so I'll even engage with the person who hasn't overcome their fragility and is still like off the hinges. And like, right, as long as I know that, hey, this person's trying, they're trying to gain victory over, you know, all this conditioning that they've received through the education system, through this, that, and the other. I'll spend my energy and time on that because those people may end up becoming the future leaders, you know, of the church.
Sure.
But when it comes to people who are just stubborn and obstinate and have chosen to just dig their feet down and ungraciousness and not even seek to engage but just misrepresent and mischaracterize and slander even. I just don't have the time or energy for that.
Yeah.
And I honestly think that people like that will fall away. The church isn't going that way. God is exposing them. But there are people who still hold to a slave master or segregationist theology, and that is going away. And I think right now they may have a little bit of a following, so they think that they're going to win the day. But the church is abounding in love, and God is purifying His church. And so I'm committed to the hard and brutal work for some of us of reconciliation work, and it's hard on our families, it's hard on us. But I'm committed to it because of the outcome, and I do think that God is renewing His church, and so I am more positive and optimistic than I am pessimistic. But if I'm frank, I don't think that I will see it in my generation. I think my generation is making the way for my children.
Right.
I think that we're doing the grunt work, and my children will be the generation, hopefully, of saints who will actually experience a church that is united across racial fronts.
Well,
and walking in unity.
Yeah, that would be we could praise God if that. Yeah, absolutely. Let me throw one more scenario. Am I intruding on your time too much here?
I got a little bit more time left.
Okay,
just a little though.
I really appreciate the time. I mean, this is just absolutely fascinating to me, and just. Yeah, exactly what I was. Yeah, so hopeful when I reached out to you, and so hopeful that this was the kind of conversation we'd have, and this has been great. Here's one olive branch that I would like to see kind of put out there. My contention, and again, all this stuff. I'm standing on the shoulders of guys again, like Thomas Sowell, Jason Riley, John McWhorter, Glenn Lowry. These guys that I listen to almost religiously, read their books, all that sort of thing. One of my big time concerns is the black family, and how it's deteriorated since the 1960s until now. And I am convinced, and then this is one reason why I would just so love to teach black men how to drive trucks so they could provide for their families without getting into the narco economy, because whole thing is a whole nother issue. I'm not going to bring up in my opinions on it, because that's one place I break from my I'm a Republican. I break from my party on that. The whole that whole war on drugs thing, I'm very against. I think that's one of the root causes of the mass incarceration of black men. But one of the main drivers behind me wanting to teach underprivileged people how to drive trucks is because I think that what's breaking down is the family. And that's one thing I would like to hear talked about more. If we're going to approach this from a church, from a Christian perspective, is exhorting men to be men. And if they're going to father a child, they need to be a father to that child. And this is something that the mainstream secular, quote unquote, social justice movement doesn't seem to, in fact, seems to recoil at. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that topic.
Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of, grind that you have to kind of get through to get to, you know, what's really going on. And what are the real challenges facing? So you have things like, again, black on black crime, which is a racialized term to dehumanize the black community, because white on white crime, black on black crime, look at the statistics, it's the same. Yeah. You know, it's a matter of where you are geographically, demographically. It's not a matter of somehow that, oh, black people are more violent than white people. And so you have these categories or these assumptions or these assertions that are made about where the black family really is that not necessarily accurate. So if we look at the ghetto and we look at how the family structure the ghetto, and then we look at trailer parks and how are the cultures in white trailer parks or redneck communities, we'll see some parallels here that are based more on class than they are based on race. Hmm. That does not mean that there is not a problem. And I'm a racial trauma counselor, so I do a lot of race based trauma, and I've even been accused by men like White and others of building into a victimology that my work as a racial trauma counselor is basically just helping people become victims. But in reality, it's the complete and utter opposite. No abuse or trauma counselor is cultivating victims. They're helping people be liberated from ideologies of victimhood. You know, that's the whole point. You know, but what I would say is that mass incarceration has indeed devastated the black community. Yep. It's removed a lot of black fathers from the home for petty crimes, typically crimes that white people don't get absolutely no jail time for. But when they get out of those communities, so it's a ruthless cycle. When you have trauma, you then have coping, which includes maybe getting high, then getting arrested for getting high, then going to prison because you have trace amounts of marijuana on you, when the average person would just get a slap on the wrist or a small fine. Right. Now you're out of prison, you can't get a legitimate job, and you can't vote, and you become a second-class citizen. And so now, and then the spiral continues.
Right.
And so I think that one of the areas in which the black community and the black family needs a profound level of help in is in the very work that I do as a racial trauma counselor. I think that the black community is a traumatized community that's never dealt with the trauma. And there's a lot of it that affects the eating dynamics, the health of the black community. It affects the family. It affects the psychology. It affects tons of things. And so I think that the church should lead the way in providing soul care for black families and the black community, so that people can actually get out of trauma that is actually keeping them down. I wrote an article, I don't know if you ever saw it, on Dr. King, the Church and Racial Trauma, where I talked about how Dr. King himself talked about this. One of the reasons he said he can't wait to, you know, as people were telling him he needed to, was because of the airtight cage of poverty. The trauma that was being caused in the black community from the forced impoverishedness was traumatizing people. He talked about how, because the colorism and the racialization that his daughter had of why she couldn't go to Funtown, that cultivated that trauma, led, you know, was impacting her to a degree that he could not wait. He saw his son becoming a racist. And he was like, I can't have my son becoming a racist because he's being racialized. And so Dr. King gives all these examples of why he can't wait. And many of them are directly connected to the trauma that was impacting the black community. And there's a stigma of mental illness as it relates to the black community and this baggage there. And there's also the community as a whole hasn't grasped the fact that they have not yet dealt with a lot of trauma that's there, which is leading to various practices, some of which is actually culminating in, again, mass incarceration and that whole cycle that I get. Right. So I think that there is a lot of profound trauma that needs to be dealt with. I only know one other racial trauma counselor. I'm a therapist, and so I'm one of two that I know. It's a very new field. There's not many people that are doing any kind of work, especially church-related. I'm the only biblical counselor, church counselor, that is doing race-based trauma counseling that I know of, anyways. And so we need more people who are doing counseling within that realm to actually be counseling the black community so that we can they can be greater flourishing. I also believe that the church should lead the way in that. And I think that the black church just failed there. And I think that the white church has only perpetuated the trauma, especially because of its unresolved, devoted allegiance to the Republican Party rather than holding the Republican Party for racism and various things that they're doing that are actually contributing to the trauma, rather than, now again, Democratic Party is doing it as well. Again, there was just an ad that came up that talked about how abortion for black women is self-care. How demonic is that?
Yeah.
You know, and so it's both sides. Right. Absolutely.
Right.
Which
right.
is why the church must be central there.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest issue impacting the black community from the 60s is what happened with mass incarceration, the other dynamics, the bleed over, if you would, from Jim Crow. So again, once redlining was eliminated, you still had a bunch of ghettos in place and people without money to get out of those ghettos.
Yep.
And so the trauma that has been caused by the racialization of the black community, I think that is one of the most profound things impacting the black community in regards to, you know, where it is at right now. And so I would press that harder than most people and say that most people, I don't think, are grasping how profoundly impactful unresolved trauma has been within the black community.
Right, right. Well, that's absolutely fascinating, Kyle. I something I'd never considered, quite honestly. I rack my brain about, okay, you know, I am convinced, I mean, and I think the data bears this out, that if black families could stay intact, that you know, we'd see all these disparities just melt away. And what you're talking about is trying to help people deal with the trauma of racism and effects that have, you know, come from us from history past. You talk about redlining. I mean, that's a thing of the past, but in reality, it's not, because, like you said, it's captured these people in ghettos, and to help people cope with that sort of thing, in a way that's healthy instead of turning to drugs and violence, etc. This is something that's going to help, you know, keep the black family together. I don't know, not for nothing, but that would be a major selling point. I think I would just boast about is that you know, really what your ultimate aim is to keep black families together, and keeping black families together is a big key in all this. I mean, is that a mischaracterization of where you're going with all that?
Absolutely. And so again, I believe in the family. I believe that a family unit of a husband, a husband, a wife, and children, that is the normative that God is, you know, that God desires for, you know, for a family to function in health. And I think that there are contributing factors that don't allow that kind of structure to flourish. There's a saying that goes around within black philosophy, if you would, that says that the two greatest miracles that have impacted the black community is that it believed the slave master's gospel and that the black family is still around. Mm. Because one, it believed the slave man's gospel because of the power of the gospel. But every attempt has been made for centuries to destroy the black family. Slave days, they were ripped apart, and their wives were raped. And now you deal with mass incarceration, another way of removing men from the home, from black homes. Mm. And so every attempt has been made to destroy the black family because that's how you destroy the black community. Yep. African Americans. And so I believe that keeping the black family intact and helping the black family flourish is crucial. And I do think that trauma has huge impacts, even on health. I mean, we don't talk about the fact of why is it that the black community has such a high sugar diet. Mm. Yet we know that one of the ways in which people comfort depression is what? Comfort food, ice cream, mm. high sugar.
Sure.
And so when you think about heart disease, why is it that heart disease is normative within black men in the mid to late 30s? Why is it diabetes the same? It's because of these high sugar diets. Where did that tradition of all these high sugar, high fat diets come from? It's comfort food mm-hmm. that has become traditional because of the trauma of generations. And that infects black men dying young, black fathers dying young. So there's so many factors related to trauma that's not directly connected to racism, but it has its baggage there. Yeah. And I think that what is crucial is understanding that, coming to terms with that, seeking to stop that, which I would say is justice in the social realm. And the fruit of that is seeing black families flourish, sure. and thrive. And I would come back around and say also goes for white families, too. One of the reasons why Trump is in office is that there's a lot of poor whites who felt hopeless and felt like they were lost and no one cared about them and they didn't have no voice. And Trump gave them the illusion that he actually cared about them and that he would give them a voice. Right. And so many voted for him out of desperation. And so the same thing goes with that again, there are a lot of poor white families that are not intact. And I think the church should be the example and lead the way in helping such families remain together and intact. And I think that we've lost our way when we consider that not the mission of the church. Yeah. But the mission is just to tell people about Jesus, not to actually see people transformed.
Yeah. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. It brings salvation to those who believe. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. Tell me I'm a sinner and Christ died for me. I don't want to know about what you did last week on your summer vacation, what you saw